Head into Safeway for great summer savings. This week at Safeway, get boneless, skinless chicken breast from the butcher block or pork spare ribs from the meat department for the member price of $1.99 per pound. Plus, get Haas avocados or mangoes 10 for $10. Also this week at Safeway, get selected varieties of Coca-Cola 6-pack bottles, 7-Up 12-packs, 8-packs or 6-packs, Snapple Tea 6-packs, or 8-packs of Polar Seltzer. Buy two, get two free. Visit Safeway.com or head in-store for more great deals.
This is the College Football Fix Podcast from USA Today Sports.
And welcome back to the College Football Fix post-signing day edition for the early signing period in college football. I am Dan Wolken. Paul Meyerberg is here. And Paul, I did not expect that when we started to talk about signing day that the person that we were going to focus on was Deion Sanders. Number one player in the country, Travis Hunter, to Jackson State, was committed to Florida State. Word started to percolate early on Wednesday that he was potentially going to go to Jackson State, get out of that commitment, sign with Deion Sanders. It happened. It's real. The number one player in the country is going to play FCS football. It is, to me, the most stunning, surprising recruiting day turn of events I've ever seen.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything close in terms of, like, it's not like he went to Purdue. Actually, him going to Purdue would have been a bigger surprise than him going to Jackson State, honestly. But to go HBCU, FCS, even a really good team, coached by obviously a coach who's going to be in a Power 5 pretty soon, yeah, that was stunning. What do you make of it? I mean, what's your takeaway of it?
This is the whole thing. Like, what does it mean? You know, and that's what we're all trying to figure out and talk about today is, what does this mean for college football? Because what I think we all sort of expect and believe is that there was some NIL component to this. Now, Deion Sanders and people at Jackson State have tried to shoot down this idea that Barstool Sports, which is a company that Deion works with, that they're involved and it's seven figures and it's going to be part of a documentary film series and whatever else. Like, we'll find out, I guess, like what exactly the parameters of the deal were. And when he starts to put stuff on his Twitter timeline about products or whatever, what potential NIL thing was here. And look, I think that just broadly speaking, yeah, like NIL, the possibility that somebody could get a lot of money for going to a specific school does change things to the extent that, yeah, a program like a Jackson State could get a number one player in the country because it's just a very specific, unique situation. There are going to be one-off guys who are able to sign these deals for whatever reason. At the same time, you go to the rankings and it's Alabama, Georgia, Ohio State, Texas A&M, Texas, Penn State, Notre Dame, the same schools that are always in the top 10 of the recruiting rankings, top 15 of the recruiting rankings. So part of me is like, yeah, this is a transformational day. This is a massive statement about the power of NIL that a kid can do this. On the other hand, like, it's one player here and there, and we're not going to get a whole bunch of guys going to HBCUs. That's not going to happen. And hell, Deion may not even be at Jackson State a year from now. So, you know, is this a Deion thing? Is this an NIL thing? I don't know. I think there's just a lot of different possibilities, and I'm not sure which one, you know, really explains it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a Deion thing, right? I mean, I don't think he's going to Jackson State if Deion's not there, and there may be money involved in the back end. I mean, there would have been money involved for Hunter no matter where he went to school. If he went to Tallahassee, he'd be getting NIL money. So I think it has a lot to do with Deion, as you wrote yesterday. I think there was not like this embrace of Deion as a coach.
Yeah.
Even though he went 11-1 last year, there still hasn't been this full-on embrace of him as a serious coach, you know, just kind of a joking part-time coach. But clearly he's a guy that if you hired him now at a Power 5 job, it wouldn't feel like a gimmick. You know, based off the fact that he's recruiting well, he's obviously had success, and he seems invested in the process. So that to me is the bigger story than NIL. NIL, like you said, is not going to impact the world of college football, but it will impact individual players.
Yeah, two years ago, I remember talking to folks when I was doing a lot of stuff on the coaching carousel, and somebody had told me that he had interviewed with Arkansas. Deion Sanders had interviewed with Arkansas. Now, at that time, he was basically the offensive coordinator for the high school that his sons were playing at in, I guess, in Dallas. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you kind of sit there and go, wait a second. Arkansas interviewed Deion Sanders? What's up with that? Is this a favor to Jerry Jones? Like, what is going on here? And it just never sort of computed that Deion Sanders, primetime, guy who was on all over television, mm-hmm. you know, guy who is a Hall of Fame type player, that he would be interested, that he would want everything that comes with coaching college football. And yet the more people who I talked to who had spoken with him said they were very impressed, you know, that they were surprised by how seriously, how thorough he was, how seriously he was taking all this. But nobody would pull the trigger. So he ends up going to Jackson State last year, very, you know, sort of low risk gamble for a program like Jackson State. Last year is a wash because of COVID, playing in the spring and all that. This year they're 11-1. They've won games. They've been really good. And they're not just good on offense or a well-balanced team. They played well defensively. Deion's kid is the quarterback, and he's a really good player. Like, all these things are interesting. But something like this gets people's attention in a way that even, you know, kind of running through the SWAC doesn't quite register for the common fan and even administrators. And, you know, Deion sniffed around a couple jobs at the FBS level this year, didn't really get very far. I think by next year, like, if they have another solid season on the field, the fact that he can recruit at this level, get in the game when he's got the resources of Jackson State, I do think people will look at that and say, boy, put him in a real job, a Power 5 job, what could he possibly do?
Yeah, and I get that. I mean, I'm way more on board with that idea than I was 2 years ago. Like I said, it felt like a gimmick, and that's more about how I perceived it than Deion's investment in it. But I'd love to see him get that, like, one of those number 20 through 40 Power 5 jobs. I don't think that I'm at the point where I would give him the keys, unless it's Florida State, to an elite blue blood and let him run with it. I don't think I'd have that sort of faith, but a place like TCU, for example, would have been a nice fit because he knows Dallas, knows the recruiting scene. You know, one of those jobs, not the top 15 jobs, but 15 through 30. I would love to see him get that kind of job. It would be fascinating to see what he could do. I don't know anything about what he does as a coach, like what they're about on offense or defense, but you're assured of him hiring a good staff and recruiting the hell out of the place, you know? And I think in college football at the highest level in the Power 5, if you recruit well and hire well, you're going to be successful.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, look, if this – what I would think – and again, neither of us have spent a lot of time watching Jackson State play. But, like, if this were a total S show, you know, if it were totally disorganized and he didn't know what he was doing, I don't think they'd be 11-1. I really don't.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But, what kind of job? I don't know. It's too early to say. I think it would certainly have to be sort of a specific – type of place that's looking for a jolt of energy and is willing to maybe roll the dice a little bit because he still doesn't have a ton of coaching experience at the highest level. And, you know, with Deion, it's going to be high maintenance and he's going to kind of take over the athletic department in a way. So there's some different factors here. Now let's talk about Florida State for a second, because, you know, they end up, still with actually a class that the 24/7 has ranked 13th, which is pretty good. Mm-hmm. Not a bad class. They got a 5-star, 6 4-stars. Like, this is a good recruiting effort for Florida State. Obviously it hurts to lose this kid. But I do think that the fact that it went down this way, there's a credibility issue now with Mike Norvell that I think that fan base is reckoning with, even though I don't think Mike Norvell did anything wrong. Like, if you want to put blame on anybody for all this, put the blame on the boosters, on the Florida State boosters, because, you know, they obviously didn't step up to the plate here, or at least we think. Now, look, I think you could argue, like, what is actually the value of a good cornerback? And, you know, if somebody is making this huge offer that it requires him to go to Jackson State, if you're Florida State, do you look at that and say, you know, I don't know about that. I don't know, because we've seen some bad investments, and there's going to be bad investments on these unproven 18-year-old kids. And we're not talking about a quarterback here. You know, guy's going to touch the ball all the time. So I don't know. But, boy, like, for a guy who just racked up the 13th-ranked recruiting class, it sure felt like a really bad day for Mike Norvell.
Yeah, it felt like a loser day for them. And that's unfortunate because, like you said, they signed a really good class. And they did so on the heels of how many straight losing seasons are we working on? Four? Four? Three? A lot. Way too many.
A lot. Way too many for Florida State.
Yeah, so I think that's a testament to the way they recruited. And look, like, they signed a five-star kid. I mean, that's a top eight class, top seven class. And, yeah, the dialogue's a little bit different. But I think it does not help that it's Deion who did it. It's bad on a lot of levels for Norvell, but that it's Deion, I think, is bad. And it's got a lot of people chatting about, hey, it's just, let's give Deion the job. He's going to recruit our guys. Let's give him the job anyway. So he needs a winning season in a really bad way. But it's hard to look at yesterday for them as anything but a disappointment, strangely, because they were just in the news for the wrong reasons. And Florida State, I think, as a fan base and as a community, they're tired of getting dismissed, and they're tired of being on the bad end of these things, you know, every Saturday, then every February, every December.
But, you know, I do think, like, if you're a school that doesn't quite have the NIL operation up and running and operating at maximum capacity, and we don't know where this is going to go, right? We're still in the infancy of NIL. Is the NCAA going to come down and start putting more regulations on it? Are they too disorganized? Is Congress going to eventually get around to doing a national law? Like, these are questions none of us can know the answer to. But if you're a school that got outbid for a guy, you better fix that, because it doesn't seem to me like this is going away.
Yeah, and I thought, Dan, coming out of when NIL stuff really landed and we saw an idea of what it was going to be like by state, I think there was this belief that it would simply be a matter of, we're a big name and we have people who will cut checks. And, hey, come to wherever, come to Notre Dame or come to Kansas, we'll take care of you. You know what I mean, that idea? But clearly, at this point, if you don't have an alignment, a serious degree of alignment between your athletic department and the opportunities for NIL that await when a guy get on campus, you're in trouble. Like, you need to have that set up and be able to portray that immediately. Because even if there's no money on the table today or yesterday, everyone knows what kind of situation they're walking into. So if Florida State doesn't have their ducks in a row in terms of being able to show what opportunities await when they get on campus, that's a serious problem. And that's a serious problem when you get into a bidding war, potentially, quote unquote, with another school or with a place like Jackson State. If you can't step up to the plate, then kids are going to go elsewhere. That's the new world, I think, that you can't be waiting till guys get there to show them what they can catch in it.
Yeah. And it takes organization. It takes legwork. It takes a lot of people pulling in the same direction. And, you know, I think we're in an era now where, at least from where I sit, this whole idea about cheating and buying players, like, that's all gone. Like, it's basically all the things that you need to do to get players have basically been made legal and available. And so, you know, maybe there are some schools and some coaches who, you know, didn't want to cheat in the past and didn't want to get things done for players. And now they have somewhat level footing to do that. I still think players are going to make decisions largely based on how close the campus is from home, the coach, the system, you know, all the traditional things. But certainly, you know, if a school is going to go all in on one guy, then that could, you know, at least on the margins, spread the talent around a little bit. Other takeaways from signing day. Well, I mean, at least according to several of these rankings, Texas A&M ended up with the number one recruiting class. And you had some thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, this is a group that is so good that it definitely played a role in Jimbo Fisher not leaving. I don't think he wanted to play this group for the next 4 or 5 years at LSU, if that was ever an option. It's an outstanding group. They got a 5-star QB, a couple of wins on signing day itself. And after kind of an uneven year, I think it's a big, big, big day for A&M, a really big day. This kid they're bringing in at QB potentially is a true freshman starter. Immediate help on both lines. Speed on the outside. I don't know about their skill talent, like what they're getting at running back and wide receiver, to be quite honest, but I think it's an outstanding class. And look, I mean, we knew the SEC was going to dominate, but you saw Texas inside the top 5 or 6 for most of the day. Sarkisian needed that. They had a bunch of kids come in, I think, or Quinn Ewers being one of them, that are ready to play immediately. A bunch of flips. So I think it's a good day for a lot of a good day for the SEC, but also a good day for some programs that, like A&M, like Texas, needed to have a good signing day to kind of reshape the narrative after the last couple months.
What I'm going to be really interested to see from this Texas A&M class is what happens at the quarterback position. Because one of the guys they signed, Connor Wegman, 5-star kid out of Cypress, Texas, rated number 2 at his position nationally, number 19 overall prospect. Obviously, very, very highly regarded quarterback. Here's an interesting fact. The last good quarterback, really good quarterback, that Jimbo Fisher recruited was Jameis Winston. Now, that's a long time ago. But think about after Jameis at Florida State, I mean, it was a mess. It was, it was Sean McGuire, who was okay.
Patrick Olsen.
Yeah, but he was a transfer.
Yeah, just thinking of the QBs they had after that. And if you remember, before Winston left, he had like 4 or 5 first round QBs in a row.
Yeah, I mean, you had EJ Manuel,
Christian Ponder.
Yeah. So after Jameis, I mean, they DeAndre Francois, James Blackman, like these were not really good hits in terms of evaluation and development for Jimbo Fisher. And since he's been at Texas A&M, he got there, he inherited Kellen Mond, who by the end of his career turned into a pretty good quarterback. Mm-hmm. And then this year it was pretty uninspiring at that position. So, I mean, again, they've recruited a ton of good players at A&M since Jimbo's been there, and that will give you a baseline level of success. But the quarterback position, I just think, is the big unknown, because he runs a complicated pro-style system. It's a lot of information for – at least that's the reputation. It's a lot of information for the quarterbacks to handle. And guys just have not developed in that system really since Jameis. So I'm going to be very curious to see how it goes.
Yeah, he loves this Wegman kid. I mean, he's been talking about him like – obliquely and then straight up yesterday as, the best QB he signed in a long time, top QB in the country. And he almost is by every recruiting ranking anyway, but
yeah.
Fascinating. They lost Calzada to the portal. I mean, outside of that Alabama game, all due respect to him, he was pretty bad. So that's no loss, but between Haynes King and Wegman, that's an interesting QB battle. I think fairly, despite the fact that they're going to go 9-4, 8-5, A&M should enter next year as the team you say they can win a national championship if they get what they need at quarterback, because they're that talented, they're that deep, they're that primed to make that run. So it's probably at this point, look at all the other teams in the country that are going to be in the position where they'll be fighting for preseason number one. They'll have settled QB competitions, maybe not at Georgia, but most of those teams. So that QB competition in College Station, that's going to be one of the stories of the offseason. So really fascinating. I mean, there was this idea that Fisher at the end of FSU, rightfully so, was, getting home at 6 o'clock every day to watch Jeopardy, not putting the hours in. I think we can kind of put that to bed with this class. I think this class at A&M is transformative to be better than A&M, better than Alabama, better than Georgia. That's just wild. And look, I want to say one thing. Your alma mater, for example, Vanderbilt, signed an outstanding class for the fact that they suck. Like 31st, 32nd in the country. That's second to last in the SEC. And when Florida gets its act together for the second day, they're going to have the lowest ranked class in the SEC, probably like 34th or 35th nationally. I mean, that's crazy, Dan.
That means they're
still going to go 0-8, but with really, but they're going to beat the hell out of four teams in non-conference play, but still go 0-8.
Well, you never know. I mean,
yeah, they can
We'll see. We'll see what Clark Lee can do. But that was a great signing class.
Terrific class. Yeah.
But it's tough. I mean, so you know, Alabama number two, Georgia number three. Georgia got 5 5-star players.
Yeah.
5. And what's interesting is 3 of them are from Florida.
I bet you Georgia got more 5-star talent than the entire Big Ten West got 4-stars, or as many. I wonder if the entire Big Ten West combined for 5 4-star recruits. I have to look that up. Probably. But not that many more. So I don't know what you do. I don't know what you do. If you're a team in the Big Ten or the ACC and you want to play for a national championship and you're looking at Vanderbilt's got a better class, then what do you do? Just stop. Let's go to the NFL. There's an opening in the Jaguars. Go take that job. Get out of it.
It's tough. Texas was a winner on signing day. They got a couple late flips and a couple big commitments late, so I think they're very happy. Steve Sarkisian, the reason why he was a hot coaching candidate last year, not just the scheme, but the ability to recruit, which he did at USC. He did well at Washington. And Texas certainly delivered. You had Michigan at number 9. 24 commits, 10 4-star players, 1 5-star. Got a couple guys late. Certainly seems like residue from the fact that they won the Big Ten and finally beat Ohio State, and they're going to the college football playoff. I mean, that's a strong, strong close and more evidence that Jim Harbaugh's kind of got his mojo back.
Yeah, they had a good class. Ohio State has always had a good class, but I didn't get the impression from watching Ryan Day yesterday that he was, like, ecstatic about it. I think a lot of that had to do with a couple of losses late. One guy that flipped to Texas, a cornerback who would have filled a huge role for the Buckeyes, and I think he'll play quickly, this kid Brooks at Texas. But yeah, Michigan State, even Indiana, strangely, yeah. The entire Big Ten East had a really good day, a really good day. Even Rutgers somewhere in the 30 to 35 range. So Michigan's one of those schools that really cashed in terms of being able to turn a hot season into a strong close. Kentucky, another school that did the same thing. I mean, they finished in the top 12 or 13.
How about Missouri? Missouri was
14th?
12th at 24/7.
Wow, that's crazy. Yeah, Eli Drinkwitz is a nerdy closer, but he closes. Guys like him. Coaches like him. Players like him, even though he's a science teacher. So that's a really good class for Missouri.
Meanwhile, you know, a couple coaches who kind of seem to be pouty and complainy as signing day drew near, probably didn't have awesome signing days. One was Dabo Swinney at Clemson. Now, they only have 13 players committed. They seemed like, you know, very selective and potentially smaller class. And, you know, they have 8 4-star players, a 5-star. But, you know, their signing class didn't really blow anybody away. And then Ole Miss at 24, which is good. It's a top 25 class, but it's behind South Carolina. It's behind Mississippi State, at least in these rankings. It's behind Arkansas. And Lane, you know, was out there bemoaning free agency and all this stuff. I just sort of wonder, like, is this now just a thing where if you don't embrace what this new world is, you're not going to thrive in it?
Yeah. Let's not even go into any coach at the highest level of this sport talking about free agency. Please have some self-awareness. My God, man. We have mentioned on this podcast, and we both, I think, have heard the same thing, that Ole Miss recruiting is not a well-oiled machine in terms of interest, activity, commitment to closing down the borders. It just isn't there. So I'm not surprised at all that we get to a point where they're still top 25, because it's hard not to be. But that's 13th in the SEC. I'm sorry, 12th in the SEC. And that's not going to win you a conference championship. That's not going to get you back into the New Year's Six. So that's an issue for Ole Miss. For Clemson, like, I think you're sitting at 13 to a degree. because in the last 10 days, you've lost Elliott to Virginia, Venables to Oklahoma. And I think it's hard to close on that, you know? I don't know if we want to get off recruiting for a second, but they did fill their staff. Dabo did the other day. As expected, Brandon Streeter is going to call plays. Wes Goodwin, who's been a long-time support staffer, analyst, all-around helper, off-the-field guy for Venables and that defensive staff. He's the co-defensive coordinator. I don't know how long it's been since he was a full-time coach. At least 10 years or so. I don't want to say strange hires. I think Dabo has done a nice job of promoting within staff. He's hit a home run every single time, but strange.
Yeah, no, let's talk about Clemson for a minute. I think it's a good point to maybe branch out a little bit, and it does tie into what happened on signing day. This is a very interesting moment in time for Clemson. Dan Radakovich, the athletic director, he's taken the job at Miami. We expect that Graham Neff, who is the number two in that department, is going to be promoted. So there's continuity there. And I think Graham is very talented, very good. I don't think they're going to drop off at the athletic director position. But, you know, Venables is a loss. Tony Elliott, I think, is a loss. And when you have that amount of turnover, by the way, Thad Turnipseed, a loss. Thad Turnipseed, who was kind of the... I would almost call him the GM.
Consigliere.
Just responsible for a lot of organizational logistics stuff. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the recruiting stuff, too. He is going with Venables to Oklahoma. And, you know, you could look at this opportunity and say, let's bring in some outside voices and rev this thing back up and maybe shift directions a little bit and try some new things after the season they just had, which, you know, has ended well, but ultimately was disappointing given what we thought it could be at the beginning. Instead, Dabo's gone the other way and just keeps doubling and tripling and quadrupling down on the internal development of guys who've been in his system. I'm not here to tell you whether it's right, wrong, it's going to work, it's not going to work. I can't tell the future, but I do think that it's hard to keep replacing guys internally. At some point you are going to hit a bad decision, you know, and Clemson's been remarkably stable. I mean, hiring Brent Venables all those years ago really changed the entire Clemson program in a lot of ways. Totally changed the character of their program, the competitive character. It's why they won two national championships. And so now you have to replace a lot. And you know, Dabo said at his press conference, you know, if after everything you've seen the last 13 years, you don't believe in me, then there's nothing more I can do for you. I mean, I'm not quoting him exactly, but that was the gist of what he said. And I think he's right about that. Like, you do have to just trust that he knows what he's doing and that he's going to make good staff decisions. But if we're sitting here in 4 years and Clemson has kind of regressed to being just kind of a good but not championship level program, I think we'll be able to pinpoint why and how.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. We could look back on this as a turning point, an opportunity to get new voices, new ideas, new themes into your building. And you decided not to. He's absolutely right that if you don't trust me now, you never will. He's made a series of really good hires going back, let's see, 7 years to Chad Morris, or 8 years to Morris. I don't remember exactly when that was. And look, a lot of those hires weren't like, they didn't throw a parade for Chad Morris when he got that job. And Brent Venables looked like a no-brainer now. Wasn't necessarily a no-brainer then.
No,
I mean,
no.
You just had Kevin Steele give up 70 points and you handed it over to Brent Venables, whose defense gave up, you know, 50 on a regular basis this last year, or whatever the number was. So it's all worked out for Clemson. I just don't I don't feel a whole lot of confidence that this is going to continue. They're still going to be really good, but I just don't. Venables, in particular, like you said, he was the. I think as much as Dabo is the guy from, like, you know, up in the throne and ruling things from his chair, I think Clemson as a program took a lot of day to day energy, certainly on game day energy, from the way Venables prepared, the way he practiced, and his energy on the sidelines. So that's going to be a drop off there. And I'm really curious to see how they replace that energy, not to mention just the pure X's and O's. I mean, how many times have we seen Venables, or had we seen Venables put up a masterpiece? I mean, just in the history of the sport, in terms of his impact as a coordinator, I don't know who you match up that with and who matches it. Irk Russell, maybe Bud Foster for stretches at Virginia Tech. So truly impactful. And I would have thought at this point, maybe there would have been a desire to bring in somebody who could have impacted the tenor of the program the way Venables did.
Yeah.
Maybe Goodwin does, but I don't know if he will.
This happened last week after we finished recording the podcast, but what did you think of Tony Elliott actually taking that Virginia job? On the surface, it seems like the right kind of place that would fit his personality if he's, you know, got the goods to be an elite level head coach.
Yeah, it does seem to fit his mindset. I think how that process unfolded was illustrative of the way that he's approached every opening for years. I mean, almost didn't
very deliberate.
Yeah, until he saw there was going to be a commitment down the line. So the pieces are there left by Mendenhall that this is not like a tear down rebuild. I think they can be successful from the start. This should be a bowl team every year that he's there. I mean, at least in the first year or two, because the talent that is left over. So in general, I like the hire. I think it's hard to find fault with it. He's a guy who's been waiting for this opportunity. I think for Virginia, you have to feel pretty good about getting it.
And he was one of the last pieces to fall in place for the coaching carousel. For now, there are no openings. Dan Lanning to Oregon, and which we'll talk about in a second. And Stan Drayton, the running backs coach of Texas, gets the head coaching job at Temple. So for now, there are no jobs open. There could be if there's an NFL team that calls on a college coach, although I'm not sure at this point that's going to be high on a lot of people's priority lists, given kind of what's happened with Urban and Matt Rule's gotten himself a little bit behind the eight ball. So I don't know that that's very likely. Maybe there's a surprise, you know, off-season retirement or something like that. You never know exactly, but I think we're done for the year. Dan Lanning to Oregon, I thought was one of the more interesting hires of the entire cycle. And, you know, so much has happened. It kind of feels like forever ago, but I do think it's worth talking about because Oregon's done something really, really interesting here. Dan Lanning is like 35 years old. He was the defensive coordinator at Georgia. And I think everybody in college football, around college football, knew that he was going to get, you know, a good head coaching opportunity pretty early. He ends up at Oregon, does not have ties to the region. He's not a West Coast guy. Oregon's just going for best coach available, best recruiter available. He's bringing in with him Kenny Dillingham, who is the offensive coordinator at Florida State, who's – you know, he's like 31 or 32, something like that. And then on the defensive side of the ball, they're bringing in, you know, another guy kind of in that same age range. I'm blanking on the name from Baylor. But Matt Pallage is 34 years old. So he's going to be so basically head coach 35, offensive coordinator 31, defensive coordinator 34. I mean, that's a unique way to build a staff, but Utah, I mean, Oregon is going all the way in on youth in their coaching ranks.
Yeah. This is the problem of hiring 30 something coaches, that you haven't been around long enough to create your Rolodex. And that might work out fine. But that's the dice roll that you take as a program, certainly in Oregon, that you can't hire a guy who's going to be able to say, hey, I can get him, because Dan Lanning's only been coaching for X number of years, only so long under Kirby Smart. So that's a concern for me. I don't know necessarily, Dan, that you need to be like have Pac-12 experience or have Pacific Northwest experience to be at Oregon, but it would help. I'd feel a lot better about things if there was some sort of foothold out there and having an idea of what it takes to recruit to that place. So I don't know what to make of it other than the fact that you have some confidence in the job or in the hire because, like you said, he's been identified as the future head coach for more than a year. And not just the future head coach at, you know, Old Dominion, but a future head coach immediately Power 5 level, probably a premier Power 5 job. I just didn't think that it would be an Oregon-level job because Oregon wants to win a national championship.
I think what Oregon has decided institutionally, and I think they're probably right, is that they're never going to get there with the Chip Kelly model. The Chip Kelly model was a unique moment in time. It was not based on recruiting a lot of 4- and 5-star kids. And the style of play really was the driver of their success. Now that's not possible anymore. And so you've got to get players. And the problem with being located in Oregon, for the most part, the players you get are going to have to get on an airplane for, you know, 3-4 hours. 2.5 if you're in LA.
Unless you can get a flight into Eugene. So it's a challenge.
It's way out there. So I think the philosophy is we need just somebody who's great at recruiting. Somebody who can actually convince those kids to come all the way out to the Pacific Northwest. And that Willie Taggart, reputation as a great recruiter. Mario Cristobal, certainly reputation as a great recruiter. Dan Lanning, young, energetic, reputation as a great recruiter. We'll see if it works. I thought that was a guy like Florida could have looked at. They end up with Billy Napier. But, Dan Lanning, it's a fast, fast rise. I mean, it was only, 5-6 years ago, he's the recruiting coordinator at Memphis, under Norvell, and now he's running, a top 15 program.
Yeah. You're in the Pac-12, right? You're at USC. You just hired a 3-time playoff coach, Lincoln Riley, who's got a couple Heisman winners, almost an impeccable track record. And you're the other two teams in that conference who willingly want to win national, who believe rightfully perhaps that they can win national championships. And you've hired Kellen DeBoer and Dan Lanning. Those hires might pan out. But I think if you're USC, you're thinking, wow, this is great. I'm really happy about how things have progressed right here. And I think that's the right way to think.
Yeah, I don't know that Dan Lanning is, at least on paper, going to scare Lincoln Riley or scare anybody at USC, but I think it's got the potential to work out pretty well. And by the way, he should have a pretty damn good football team coming back next year.
Yeah, they were really young this year. I think that was overlooked as we kind of gave them a grief for the way they played against Utah. Young team, need to get a lot better at quarterback. But the pieces are there for them to be really successful. And maybe, Dan, this is the idea, the Marcus Freeman idea. We think he's the right guy for us, for our future. And we also think that there's the surrounding support with our staff, with our administration, and this roster to help him get to the point where he's ready to drive this ship on his own. And maybe there's a little bit of a feeling like that at Oregon. Like you said, the talent and the roster are there to be really successful from the start. So maybe there's a learning curve and the talent allows him to get over it and get past the hump.
You mentioned Oregon needing to be a better quarterback. We are now officially in the quarterback merry-go-round season, musical chairs, whatever game you want to call it. A ton of guys in the portal, a ton, which is not surprising. Like, this is the new normal. You are giving these players one free transfer where they can go anywhere they want, don't have to sit out a year. One guy plays quarterback. This is just the way life is in college football these days, and I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I think guys should go where they feel like they're going to have an opportunity to play and develop. The biggest name so far to land is Spencer Rattler, former Oklahoma quarterback, preseason Heisman Trophy favorite, if you can believe it. Ends up at South Carolina. Now, on paper, I will say that's a big, big get, a big hit for Shane Beamer, because you're talking about a guy with a big, big name, big reputation, all the talent in the world, played under Lincoln Riley, reuniting with Shane Beamer, who was at Oklahoma previously. In reality, is it going to work? I don't know, because I do think there's been some holes in Spencer Rattler's game. But, when you start to look at the SEC and the lack of quarterbacks, I would say, going into next year, it does certainly give South Carolina, who had a really surprising season, 6-6, gives them a nice little boost on paper, I would think, if Rattler can – if the change of scenery does what they hope it does for him.
Yeah, I think Beamer knows the personality, knows what they're getting into with Rattler, and thinks he can handle it, then God bless him. I hope it works out for both of them. But in terms of, I don't think at all, I'm not like sold that Spencer Rattler is going to go back and be a Heisman Trophy guy. That ship has sailed. But like you said, he's an obvious upgrade, big time for South Carolina. They had to play famously a graduate assistant manager at QB the first couple games of the year. Looking at that East, we mentioned it before, I don't know what Georgia's QB situation is going to look like, but Spencer Rattler at this point, based off who's returning and question marks, he's the second best QB in the East behind Hendon Hooker, maybe the best quarterback in the SEC East. So South Carolina wants to build off last year or this past year. Getting a five-star QB with his arm talent is the way to do it. So it's a fascinating marriage. I think it'll work out fine. I just don't think that he's going to, you know, throw for 4,000 yards, 40 TDs, and have a Bryce Young type of year. That's ridiculous.
Are there any sort of QB names in the portal right now that you're super interested to see where they land? A lot of probably just notoriety around Bo Nix leaving Auburn.
That's a fascinating move considering his ties to the school. First off, I think this is like the first round of it. I kind of feel like we'll have aftershocks of this probably right before spring or right after spring.
Yeah, right after spring practice, because start to see these depth charts and guys maybe have more competition than they bargained for.
Yeah, but Nix is a fascinating one. Slovis out of SC.
Yeah, Keaton Slovis.
Yeah, Slovis is interesting because of his experience in a pass-first, pass-heavy offense and the fact that I think he's really motivated because we're like 12 months or so removed from him being, hey, this kid could be a first-round pick to him, playing backup to Jackson Dart. So that's a really fascinating one to me. Miles Brennan's going to stick at LSU after talking to Brian Kelly. So that's one guy off the board. I don't think we're done. I don't think we're done in this round. I think there are other big names that are going to announce in the next couple weeks. Like, for example, what is a guy like JT Daniels going to do, right? Like, what does his future look like? He's an interesting case because he's got to transfer twice, so he's got to get a waiver to do it. But I think there are other big names kind of percolating that could come up and impact this thing further. But as of right now, Dan, I would say Nix and Slovis, unless I'm forgetting somebody, are the big names and the guys that if I was a Power 5 school for QB, I'd be all in.
Yeah, and by the way, recruiting is not done either. There's going to be more guys who sign over the next several days, and then there's going to be a period in the spring where more guys are going to sign. I think ultimately they're going to end up changing this early signing period and getting rid of it or reconfiguring it somehow, because I just think we've seen it now in practice and it's too much. I don't know that even if you eliminate it or move it to January or wherever you want to move it, I don't think that's going to change the hiring firing cycle. I think that ship has sailed. I think it's just going to get earlier and earlier. And I don't think there's much you can do about it. But I just think, like, when you look at everything that goes on this time of year, teams finish seasons, coaches leaving, the playoff, recruiting, the playoff's going to get bigger, as we talked about. We don't know exactly when, but you're going to have more teams kind of hamstrung by playoff preparation, probably actually a shorter window of time between the start of the playoff and the conference championship games. Like, it's just not going to work, right? So I do think they're going to end up getting rid of it. And you're seeing, like, the new coaches were just at such a huge disadvantage. LSU did not get a chance to sign a bunch of guys, or at least the numbers they normally would. Same thing at USC as we sit here. I think they've only got 6 signings. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I just think it was worth a shot, and I do think there was a benefit for players, but I just think in practice it's just not working. It's hurting more than it's helping.
Yeah, and I don't know what the solution is. It's certainly not to move it up. Doesn't basketball do a summer signing period or something like that? I mean, before the season starts, they have a signing date?
Yeah, they have one before the season, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a bad idea. Also saw somewhere, I don't remember where, written or suggested that there was like a rolling signing period. That is the worst idea in the world. If you want to take pressure off of kids, please do not have a 3-month rolling period where you can sign, because all they'll be asked every day is, are you going to sign today? So I don't know. Maybe we just go back to the one signing day. I don't know. But yeah, this is not working about as well as the people hope that it would. I don't think so. And the AFCA is going to do something about it. I mean, as soon as January.
Yeah, I would think so. Let's talk briefly about Urban Meyer. Fired as the head coach of the Jacksonville Jaguars. Not surprising in the least. Urban was just a disaster at the NFL. I think we both saw it coming. He just does not possess the qualities and the skills that fit within the NFL paradigm. His strengths have nothing to do with winning at the pro level. And it was just getting too embarrassing. There were the drip, drip, drip of stories and the way he treated people and things he said to players and assistant coaches. Like, it was all coming out, and it was bad. The question is, has all of this damaged him to the point where he would have trouble coming back and getting a job in college? Because at least on my Twitter feed, it seems like 90% of the people are convinced that this time next year he will be, you know, he will have offers from every top 25 job that's open to come coach them. I don't think that's going to happen. In fact, I think his career is over. What say you?
Career over. I don't know if I'd go that far, but I do not think that they're going to be like, you know, a line of private jets outside wherever he's going to be living in a couple months, like waiting to whisk him away to Austin or wherever. Don't see that happening. I think there's been a lot of damage done these last few months. And strangely, like, it took him sucking the NFL for us to realize that, hey, maybe this dude isn't the best guy to run our program and to be with our young men. He had to go 2-11 with the Jaguars for everyone to realize that. My immediate thought after these last couple of days in particular, what could have been happening in Columbus or Gainesville that went unreported with the way that he treated players or coaches? I don't know. I mean, I think we have an idea, but I think he's borderline untouchable. And yes, I would not be surprised if he never coached again. But what else is he going to do? I mean, I don't think Fox is waiting to take him back with open arms on their pregame show, though they might. I don't know what his next step even is. You know what it is? The junior senator from the state of Ohio, Urban Meyer.
Yeah, I was going to say he could get into politics or something like that. That would not surprise me at all. Yeah, I just think, like, I don't see Urban getting a job in the American Athletic Conference. You know what I mean? I don't see Urban taking the Iowa State job. You know, I just don't see it. He would have to go to a place where he felt like he could win it all. And I don't think those schools – there may be some schools that would hire him. I don't think it's as many as people think, but there are some. I don't think any of the elite jobs would hire him at this point. I really don't.
You don't think just that if Sark went 4-8 and Texas somehow found $60 million, $50 million bucks underneath the couch somewhere, that they wouldn't hire Urban Meyer because they feel like, hey, we're about to go to the SEC and get our doors blown off. We need Urban Meyer.
Listen, I get it, and I understand what you're saying, and I think logically, like, that follows the way that college sports typically operates. But I think you have to sort of ask yourself, as great as he was as a college coach, what is the next 5 years of Urban Meyer look like? And does his system, his approach, still resonate the same way? Because, you know, I felt like after the Zach Smith stuff came out, yeah, I mean, they won games and they made the Rose Bowl that year, but it felt to me like he had lost a little bit of his effectiveness because of how that went down and just how bad of a look it was, and he was suspended, and it just kind of felt like, and again, like, I know, like, they went, you know, they went 13-1, all right, and they won the Rose Bowl and they won the Big Ten. They did not make the playoff. But they it just felt to me like the trajectory was sinking a little bit that last year with Urban. You know, they got in that overtime game against Maryland. You know, they were life and death to beat Nebraska. You know, it just didn't feel right. I don't know. And I just think, like, in this era, the portal, the NIL stuff, we're just seeing people do it differently and not evolving in the direction of the Meyer type of coach. I think there would be a risk, actually, of him not doing well if he went back to college.
Yeah. Well,
and especially as damaged as he is coming out of this, like, he didn't just lose. He became a punchline, mm-hmm. a true punchline. Kids now who are recruits, they don't remember the Florida years, you know. And in 5 years, kids aren't going to remember the Braxton Miller Ohio State teams. You know, they're not going to remember that. So I don't know. Like, I just think his time has passed.
Yeah, I mean, like, he's an authoritarian person.
And he's also extremely paranoid.
Yeah. So if you're like a dictator and all of a sudden you've shown weakness, where does your power come from? Like, if you can't motivate kids through brute force of will and mental fortitude and strength, what are you doing? He never was, or hasn't been for a very long time, an X's and O's guy who won with schematics. I don't think we've said that about Meyer in a really long time.
They did it so, Utah. You know, yeah, Utah.
Bowling Green in Utah, really inventive. And the first couple of years of Florida, really, really inventive. That Chris Leak, Tebow year, what they did at QB, was really inventive. But I think it's been a kind of a steady decline and then renaissance under Ryan Day late. I don't know what power or sway he'd hold if guys start looking at him, you know, cockeyed and thinking, seriously, dude, aren't you the guy who kicked the kicker in pregame or, you know, tried to.
That kind of stuff sticks with you.
Yeah, I think so. So he's got to carry that baggage. And yeah, I mean, you got to be really desperate to overlook that baggage, give him $8, $9, $10 million a year and say, go to work, win us a national championship. You got to be really desperate.
Yeah. Now, you know, again, a year is a long time. We'll see what the mood is around him and what he does in the meantime, or if he just kind of disappears and goes into all the way into managing his restaurant or whatever. Who knows? But we had to at least mention Urban. All right. So next week we'll come back before Christmas with a show that kind of previews the bowl games and the playoff. The bowl games will start in a couple days. I mean, the bowl season's basically here already, so that's kind of cool. But the bulk of the games will be, you know, after Christmas. So we'll tackle that next week. But for now, that's Paul Meyerberg. I'm Dan Wolkin. This has been the College Football Fix podcast presented by USA Today Sports. Please like and subscribe on every podcast app that you have. Also, subscribe to USA Today Sports. It's cheap. It's a lot of information. It's a lot of great content. And it is the one way that ensures you will be able to read me and Paul for the next year. All right, everybody. Thanks. Have a great holiday season. We'll talk to you next week.
The College Football Fix Podcast. With Paul Meyerberg and Dan Wolkin. This is the College Football Fix Podcast from USA Today Sports.